Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Recorded history is full of war, but rarely does that history focus on the ordinary soldier. Our guest is Hod Jin. He won the National Book Award for his international bestseller, Waiting. Now, Hod Jin's remarkable ability to enhance reality through fiction comes alive in his book, War Trash. In it, he makes a place for the common man, the human being who gets caught up in war's grip and just wants to go home.
I think for many human beings, we tend to forget home is not a fixed state of affairs. It's a different, it's a fluid thing. It's our longing, our vision. And that's why, and when they return home, it's not the same thing. For big generals, for big heroes perhaps, but for every individual, common soldier, I don't think home is like that. Home is different. So in that sense, it's anti-heroic.
Hod Jin is a poet and a professor of English at Boston University, in addition to writing fiction that has received many of literature's highest awards. A native of China, Hod Jin came to the United States in 1985 as a student. After the Tiananmen massacre, he chose not to return. So like Conrad and Nabokov before him, Hod Jin is internationally known for his works written in his second language, English. In War Trash, Hod Jin makes a place in history for Chinese prisoners of war in the Korean War. Bill Russell and I were deeply impressed by Hod Jin's earlier works. As you will hear, I am confident that War Trash will turn out to be a classic. So we were especially pleased to welcome Hod Jin back to our program. Hod Jin, I am charmed by the story attributed to Michelangelo, that he would look at a piece of marble and he would see what was inside that piece of marble. Now, it may be apocryphal, but it's a really good story that he could see David inside this piece of marble. He could see what needed to be pulled out and pulled away. As I was reading War Trash, I had that very same sense of what you were doing in reverse, that you could see what it is, but you had to put the pieces together.
Sure, there are so many fragments.
Yes.
And like memoirs written by different people, few pages each piece. And my job was to how to unify, organize, make this as a whole thing, as one story.
It is one story, isn't it? And yet it's millions of stories.
I'm flattered to hear that.
Oh, yes.
For me, just try to really make one convincing, authentic story.
And it's, I think, important to say that as you talk about the people in this story, in War Trash, this is real things happening, but you have created fictional characters?
Yes, all the main characters are fictional. I created them because, you know, most of the time POW was captured and just put in jail and didn't go anywhere. So I have to create a character who could travel, who was not a regular POW.
It wasn't going to be a short story, was it?
No.
This was a novel.
Yeah, no. So he had to be able to speak English so that he could have access to different kinds of people, to the captors and to the other factions, to the Koreans. And so that's why I didn't know anybody who was like him. So I had to create such a character.
And you have created a universal character.
In a way, I hope so.
Yes, you have.
Well, he's universal, but he also is very unique. I mean, he is as Paula says, he partakes of many, many, many different things. But he is also, in a sense, alienated from everything around him.
Sure, yeah.
Is that alienation an important piece of this story?
Yeah, I think he can reflect on the situation. In other words, he can judge. That's very important. He can think. It's not just the person who acts. That's why at some moments throughout the story, he can step aside and look at the situation and give some rationality, thinking.
Which you also, and your identifying of
national characteristics as you go along, mm-hmm. very subtly, that he doesn't represent any particular national characteristic by virtue of that, right?
Maybe. I think that's true. That's true because he's unique. I think his ability to use English and really shape his mind differently from other his comrades. And he also, throughout the prison time, he read American newspapers. That is really, and other journal publications. That was his job, to gather information for the communist leaders. All these small things really shape him slightly different from others.
You characterize the Chinese character as being a very gregarious,
yes.
Drawing their identity,
yes.
from the group, which yeah. and again makes him an outsider, but it is a plausible outsider.
Sure.
I mean, he connects and then he disconnects.
Well, and he yeah. longs for that sense of connection.
Sure, he tried. He really tried to join others, but he couldn't. And I think because of his background, he was a cadet in the Nationalist Military Academy, and also he was a kind of semi-intellectual, and he was, in a way, he was alienated from his comrades.
The character of whom we speak is the lead character in Ha Jin's magnificent novel, War Trash. We're going to be back with him in a moment for a good deal more here on The Paula Gordon Show. We hope that you'll be with us. It is our great pleasure to welcome Ha Jin back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was talking about the national character. I was blown away by the book. I was charmed by your ability to let me see into national characters in ways that were not stereotypes, but gave me a sense of who was involved, and at the same time to look at forgive the fancy word, the geopolitical, mm-hmm. what was happening in the 40s and 50s with China and Korea and Japan and Russia and the United States, mm-hmm. that you were telling me a big story within this very constrained story of the prisoners of war, the POWs. Did you set out to tell me about the big story as well as the individual story?
Well, I set out to tell the individual story, one man's story, only his 50 years. But I created him as a character who can see a little bit more than others. That's why some details became very suggestive. And because he had access to different things, he can give us some kind of the big picture of the time. And because this is a first-person narrative, I have to set up a boundary for myself. And boundary can be strength if it is used well, because it can be used suggestively. In other words, in most cases, the big picture is implied, suggested, not a kind of frontal description.
And it seems to me absolutely unique. There are lots of people who've done the histories. There are people mm-hmm. who have taken sides. Mm-hmm. You could read the
yes.
papers. But the fact that you do have a boundary that is suggestive of the bigger
yes.
story, nobody seems to know this story anymore. It's like the Korean War got forgotten.
Sure. It is a forgotten war, yes.
It's that, but it's also, reading this, I realize how little I know about Korea. My impressions of Korea, Korean War, are like the Second War, and I guess to a lesser extent the Vietnam War, where it's all very macro. You see armies marching, and
sure.
you see lots of bright lights
sure. yeah.
and big booms
yeah.
and
yeah.
armies moving back and forth
yeah.
and strategic.
Sure.
And yours is, this is very much bottom up.
Sure.
I mean, these are individual stories.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this will necessarily go down as one of the great anti-war
yes, it will.
novels of all time. But and without, I mean, this it's not to say it's didactic or that it's polemical.
Not
but,
in any way.
But it's representation of the evil, the banality, the tedium, the absurdity
sure.
is just it's stunningly important.
Yeah, I I serve in the Chinese army. When people always talk about how many guns, how many planes, tanks, and troops, they talk about in terms of figures and firepower, and you know, as if this is magnificent, the grandeur, you know, and the big thing going on. And but really, how a regular soldier feels in the situation, they were the person who are going to die and going to really fight the whole thing. Going to sacrifice. So I just want to tell a soldier's story.
In case anybody has any doubts about how much I like this book.
Let me reiterate.
I do think that this is one of the great anti-war books, but it was in no way would anybody know that. It's sort of like people who've written brilliant environmental books, but it looks like an adventure story or travel. You say way into the book, that's one line, and this guy is so good at just occasionally saying something that lets you think a big thought. This is the crime of war. It reduces real human beings to abstract numbers. And it's almost as if you one day woke up and thought, this is the crime of war, and now I'm going to write this story that brings this big idea to life.
Yeah, and you know, when we talk about victory, we always think of casualties, how much the loss is, but if we think about the individual number, think about it, the person has a parent at home and a girlfriend. And the end is human complications and suffering and happiness and so many things wasted and lost.
And yet you say there's this one character, you give all of this darkness and this one character, you say, flourished because of the war.
Yes, yes. There's one guy. Yeah,
one out of 10 million. Not bad.
Sure. Yeah, see, that's another. It's another. I mean, the complexity of human situation. That's based on a factual episode. There was a young boy like that, who later became an accountant of a village. He didn't learn something in the camp because there were so many literate people around him.
It wasn't... I'm sorry, Bill, your turn. I'm
I'm sitting here listening to you, and it seems all the institutions come out badly.
All of them.
Sure.
The Communist Party, Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese government, the Nationalist government, the various military organizations, United States government, the Korean government, governments North and South, all... come out badly.
Sure.
However, the people, none of whom are perfect.
No.
In fact, most of them are very far from, and they're almost human. their humanity, and I guess this, you know, this is what novels do, is introduce us to, you know, help us experience things that, God help us, we won't have to.
Yeah, I think that's the truthful part. I think every side is capable of brutality, no matter who you are in the situation. It's not just whether you are good or bad. Humanity is, once you are in it, you just somehow the worst will come out.
Or the best.
Or the best, yes.
It was very much in that vein. You have your main character say, the enemy was brutal. Mm. But had we not done this thing, we wouldn't have gotten hurt.
That's true. That's true. The people use, you know, soldiers, others, for personal gain, and yes, and that's worse. In fact, worse than abuse, prison abuse.
I also had the sense that you could have had that said of any of the parties, that the enemy was sort of changeable. That.
Sure.
This notion of the enemy was the problem.
The violence is always avoidable. I think in most of the cases here, violent confrontations is avoidable. But the soldiers, they can't control themselves because they were ordered to do things and they were used and then abandoned.
Saying that, this is almost, and it hadn't occurred to me to say it, this is almost a meditation on hierarchies and what happens when have hierarchies, and particularly when you have hierarchies in extraordinarily constrained circumstances where the formal task is to kill people.
Yes.
and the dehumanization
yes.
that goes along with that.
Yes. And also the hierarchy, the state, state always betrays the individual. And I think the soldiers, in fact, were betrayed by the state. And
all of them.
All of them, yes.
I think that is part of why I'm so bedazzled by this, is that nobody, as Bill says, none of the institutions come out well, but without ever saying that, you expose all of the governments to the flippancy of authority, the disregard for those for whom you would think that this was being fought, and they all come out looking bad, except the individual soldiers on either side of the fence.
Yes, yes.
You have some pretty good guys on on the enemy's side.
Yes, yes. Every side, in fact, there are good people and bad people. I think that's true of any, you know, our everyday life. You always have good people, bad people everywhere, no matter where you go. Right?
Is the ante upped when they become POWs? Upping the ante, that's a peculiar... are the stakes higher?
Stakes higher. Yes, yes. And because they were all locked into the prison and this drive for the leadership. And that's a way, perhaps psychologically, for some of them is to regain power and to exonerate themselves to their former leaders, in their former leaders' eyes. And so in that sense, the prisoners could be meaner, more brutal to themselves. And so that's why it's not just the abuse from the captor. It's perhaps the most severe abuse among the prisoners.
You have a short chapter. And this is sort of if you had to pick somebody that was sort of just jumped out as a transient figure, part of the background, that is in a bizarre way sort of heroic. It is a short chapter about a nationalist translator.
Yes, sure, yes.
And it is the least plausible. I mean, it's implausible. It's unexpected.
Yes.
Because the nationalists, by and large, had behaved very badly with respect to the Chinese prisoners.
And when we come back, we can talk about the nationalist government, the Chinese government, the North and South Korean government, and this implausible is right. All of a sudden, you have an heroic moment.
Well, it goes against expectations. That's
which is the sign of a great piece of art. We'll be right back with Ha Jin. Please be with us. Ha Jin is here with us on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was just talking about a very short chapter and a character that you present in the course of your novel War Trash. How did you come up with a really pretty good guy out of the nationalist side that had been acting quite badly?
See, I don't think that the nationalists, they are by nature bad, only because they had absolute power. They were a bigger faction, and they had the support, secret support from the captors and also from the nationalist regime in Taiwan. So some of them, they just had a free hand, could get away with anything. But when I was working on the book, I thought this book would offend every side, the Chinese, the Americans, the nationalists.
Well, you know it could.
Yes. So I set up a principle for myself, and that is to be objective and fair, just to be fair and truthful to everybody. Among the nationalists, some of them, they are not bad at all. And in fact, there was a pretext among the interpreters against abuse, American abuse of the regular Chinese POWs. So that's why I created that episode, just one guy really stand out as a good guy, the nationalist thing.
When you're not even looking. I'm sorry.
This war trash operates on several levels. I only recall two places where you actually use the words war trash other than on the cover.
Yeah.
And part of it is the... And the underlying theme is the having allowed yourself to get captured. We tend to, in America, particularly now, call everybody that gets ends up as a prisoner as a hero.
Yes, that's a big cultural shock to me.
Well, it's a bit of a cultural shock to me, too. Maybe I don't read enough newspapers or watch enough television. But in the Chinese condition, at least during that period, and maybe to this, it may continue that it was dishonorable to allow yourself to become a prisoner, particularly if you were a Communist Party member.
Yeah, it was because according to the code, the conduct code, the seventh code, it says clearly under no circumstances you should allow yourself to be captured.
You should die.
You should die. The implication is you should die. In fact, this was really, I think there is a history in the Sino-Vietnamese War and in the early 80s, and there was a bomb called Glory Bomb, small bomb. They gave the bomb to some soldiers. If you were captured, you kill yourself with that bomb. It's called Glory Bomb.
Why? Just because that's the culturally...
Well, because you don't allow yourself to be captured.
Yeah, you don't need to dishonor.
Better glory, very glory than dishonor.
Yeah, that's kind of a... And also, I think as a way to enforce discipline among the troops. If everybody is willing to surrender, how could you fight? So that's why the war is really the last resort we should use. And really completely deform, distort humanity in it.
Part of why I... was captured by the book, perhaps an unfortunate metaphor to use, is that the story you're telling could be told this very moment in the conflict when America attacked Iraq. You could use it in African settings. Mm-hmm.
Peloponnesian Wars.
Peloponnesian Wars. Mm-hmm. It didn't really have to be any particular war, and it was all wars. And you also gave me a sense of the complexity within the Chinese nationalists, Chinese communists, how they related to the North Korean communists, how they all related to Russia.
Yes.
So again, it's the macro and micro, the high level and low level. Mm-hmm. How in the world did you get your hands around that as a novelist?
For me, I focus on the individual story. But the big story is there. All history books, everybody tell the micro history, the sweeping narrative. That was always available. There are different kinds.
So you read lots of that?
When I started to work on this, I didn't read any of those. I just focused on this person, and the prisoner's story. But after the first draft, I saw a lot of holes, a lot of gaps in the manuscript. So I began to do research. So I inserted here and there some suggestive details to make the book broader in that sense.
Where did you find these stories? Not the details, the things you're talking about now, but these...
But that
these,
you know that there was this young man who...
Uh-huh. Well, that whole... I mean, there must be, you tell me, 50 or 60 or 70 different stories that are integrated into this.
Yeah.
Where did you find those?
See, I gave a bibliography at the back of the book, and especially the Chinese kind. There were memoirs written by the old people, old men, and their memories are very fragmentary, and some of them are simply unwilling to recall the past.
Unwilling,
and they don't want to remember the suffering and the misery. And so they only wrote short pieces, a few pages long, a lot of repetition, incoherent. But I pick up, since I came to this country, I began somehow... intuitively began to collect this kind of material. I bought a few books in San Francisco. I often went to San Francisco, so when I visit the Chinese bookstores, I pick up two books there. And then I use different libraries and gradually gather a lot of these details. So I was always fascinated by the Korean experience. Whenever I told my wife about interesting detail, she said, why don't you write it about this? So after a long time, a few years of accumulation, I think I had basically all the details in my mind. But not until the summer of 2000 I began to really work a big story out of this.
There's a role in this for your father, who was a soldier in the Korean conflict. Is that right?
Yeah. He went to the to Korea and he was injured, but he was not captured. So he was a different kind. He was returned as a warrior, not as this kind of trash.
Did he? As a warrior, not trash.
No.
It's an interesting distinction.
I know, because he with some kind of honor. Yeah.
Did you grow up with him telling stories of that war?
No, he didn't tell me at all. He did, but I grew up in the Chinese army, so we often heard different stories. My father never said anything, but we saw people working on labor camp. Those were returnees, POWs, and they were like semi-criminals. And
what year would that have been?
In the 60s and 70s. Not until 84 these people were really rehabilitated. But again, many of them already died, and they were at the last stage of their life.
You say early on, one of your characters, I can't remember which, says that the only way to deal with the Communist Party is as their enemy.
Yeah, that's one of the national leaders.
Yeah.
You see, that leader, Han Shan, he's not that brutal, and he's quite gentle, but he was quite persuasive. And he said something like that. He was smarter than others, and he was well-educated and fluent in English as well. And he said something. I think that was true. Historically, it was true.
Well, at the end, and it's as if you set it up, because in your recap of what happened to these people, a lot of the people that did go to Taiwan, join the Nationalists, are now prospering in mainland China, invited
That's
back.
What's so surprising? the people
who were POWs, almost, I mean, I doubt that very many of them did much more than, I mean, if they were able to marry and have children.
Sure, yeah.
And have a job, they were fortunate.
Is that right?
Yeah, those who went to Taiwan, they live a normal life. Many of them served as regular officers and soldiers and I asked when I visited Taiwan, I asked people how do they live, and said they're normal, just normal citizen. And of course there are ups and downs in their lives, but they were normal. But whereas those who returned to China, they were disgraced and mistreated.
Yeah, we're maybe assuming something that not everybody knows. The Chinese who were captured, Communist Chinese who were captured in Korea, were given the option, nominally the option, of either returning to China or going to Taiwan. And there was a huge battle is the wrong word, long-standing disagreement, both during the armistice talks at Panmunjom, but also within each camp, about who would go back and who would not go back. And, they were fighting over these people, partly as, well, you tell me why they were fighting over these people.
And I think the Nationalist side, they really needed a soldier, because they just fled to Taiwan. They need manpower. And also, there are some important prisoners, such as the narrator, and he's a cadet and could speak English. So he was one of the targets. These kind of people would be useful to them. So that's why they want to take them to Taiwan. Also, it's a way to humiliate the communists. On the Chinese side, of course, they want to keep their face, get back these as many as they could. They didn't lack manpower at all. They didn't need these people, in fact.
Didn't particularly want them, except for propaganda purposes.
Yes.
Propaganda plays a large role in all of this. Let's come back in a minute. Let's talk about that propaganda piece. That's still a very current subject in the world. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to have Ha Jin back with us. Please be with us when we return in a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I have the honor to be with Ha Jin, who has written a great novel called War Trash. I found it great because it was able to tell a story without being preachy. It wasn't a sermon. And in fact, until I got to the end of the book, I did not realize that you were telling me history.
Oh,
I was amazed. I had to go back and think, oh, this actually happened, because it is so universal that I thought you had invented these events to make these things happen. So it is, of course, the mark of great art that you don't have to see the relationship to reality. In a way, I felt, and this is a question, believe it or not, I felt that you had set out to tell a big story, and this was a way to do it.
I try to tell an individual story, and I know that over the years, the Chinese POWs, they felt humiliated and wronged. I heard that they had advertised for writers who could write their story.
Oh, really?
Nobody dared, because this was a sensitive topic, and they themselves could not do it. They were old, they didn't have the education. So in that sense, I intuitively know that if I told the story well, individual story well, it may have ramifications. But as a writer, I could only focus on the story itself.
But you'd be overwhelmed by its hugeness.
Yes, but I was aware that this is not just a one person's story at all. That's why the narrator, in fact, struggled. Even toward the end, he said, I try to tell my own story, but it's not, you know, there is a kind of a contradiction there, because the title is War Trash. By telling his own story, basically he tells a group story.
I keep
Paula mentioned art, and you, in about a page, do a nice little subtle meditation on art, talking about the performances, the various songs that were written in camp, and the performances.
And how exciting it is that this situation calls out art in people.
And people would get excited, and it was a way of coming together and maintaining morale and a whole bunch of other things. But it's that process, you know, occurs all through your book, because in the prison camps.
In lots of ways.
But at some point, you sort of parenthetically, briefly, do a nice little meditation on art.
Yes, the narrator, yes, he does that, because he's an outsider. He couldn't sing. He tried, but
they were making instruments and he couldn't play them, and they were doing plays and he couldn't act.
And so he was an outsider. But yes, for the prisoners, this is a way of association, and to also is kind of cathartic experience, need, I think, to purge the pain. But for him, he could step aside and think about this. The question for him, is this art or propaganda? Sometimes the two perhaps are not distinguishable. And so in that sense, I think that make him different. And I think also a novel is not certainly just about fight and the confrontation. You need moments calm and try to bring rationality to the experience and let the readers think.
The thing that struck me was the juxtaposition of what was happening in the camps, which, you know, basically somebody would write a song and they'd perform it. And the question is one of the critical distinctions, as I read it, was the willingness to go back and improve it and improve it and make it better and
which
make it better.
Which they did not do.
You know, to exercise the discipline and the diligence.
Yes.
To make it not only better, but much better.
That's why. I think that's why so they were very pragmatic people, and as soldiers, you have to, and yes, they don't have the vision. Everything was conceived as for a purpose, immediate purpose.
And then there's the great line that the songs in particular, but the art, he was saying in this meditation, it had power, but it did not have beauty.
That's true.
As with you, Bill, I like the book. It all the way through, there are those moments that you have a sense of the totality of the experience. This is a war story. This is any war story. This is a POW, prisoner of war story. Any prisoner of war story. It's any captor's story. What happens to the captor by virtue of being the captor, the guy who is holding them? What happens to the soldier?
Sure, yes. And yeah, I think that's that episode, General Matthew Bell in this book, is based upon the real character, Francis Dodd. And he was busted to colonel. And
busted?
Humiliated. And in fact, he was mistreated and by the American army, and at least on paper, I never read a positive word in English about him. But in the Chinese side, the soldiers really respected him, a lot of good things, a lot of praise. That's why I created the character in a way to counterbalance what is officially written in English. So I had to do a lot of things. I can't trust the written word. I have to compare to see what is true, what is propaganda or censored.
There may be a lesson in that.
you were talking about those people advertising for somebody to write their story, and the only way that makes sense to me is a deep human craving for justice. You mentioned early on the betrayal,
yes,
by the governments of the soldiers, and it's both of those are big. Issues, and they are universal issues.
Yes.
They manifest themselves differently, but we are all concerned about them. And it seems that this story is, and this is part of the universality of it, the justice and injustice, you know, where does it come from?
From all parties.
Yes.
Which includes specifically the abuse of power. That's how a lot of injustice gets done. But also that sense of betrayal, which is sort of the other side. It's one it's one way that the injustice is perpetrated.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that's right at the core, the heart of what this is all about.
Yes, I think really justice is a big issue here. And although the narrator doesn't say it, but I think the drama, the action itself is a message. How human beings can behave decently as human beings. That's why in the very beginning he wanted his grandson to be a doctor. He thought you can follow different rules as a doctor. You don't have to worry about anything else. You just save lives. And also there are a lot, some people, you know, people who really, who try to be fair, try to be good, try to be decent. And so for me, basically, all I try to do is try to make the story speak, and the story, once it is convincing, the authentic itself is a message.
I was enchanted with your use of English. I mean, the beauty of your craft. And every once in a while, something would click in the back of my head saying, and Hodgins' native tongue is Chinese. How would this story be different had you written it in Chinese?
It'd be very different, I think. The sentiment would be very different.
The sentiment?
See, this story is very close to the, you know, Dostoevsky. I was heavily influenced by The House of the Dead. I read that book four times before I began to work on this. So it is Western. I think Russell Banks was very right. I really follow the Western tradition, the memoir form, novel in the memoir form.
The Bell Tolls, The Red Badge of Courage.
Sure, yes. And so I think that is a Western tradition. But if I wrote this in Chinese, I think the sentiment would be slightly different. Chinese might not accept this kind of a really rather brutal, unsentimental, stark prose. They like literary, more literary prose. On the other hand, it's hard to tell. Once the book is strong enough, it itself can set up a standard. In other words, to alter the taste a little bit. But the disadvantage in Chinese would be I wouldn't have the sources. See, there's so much written in English. By comparison, the Chinese sources are much less reliable.
Do you expect it to be translated into Chinese?
I don't know. There's somebody, who is translating it now, but so far no publisher has bought it. By comparison, the Korean side immediately they jump at it and bought it the Korean right.
Huh. I've got an even more direct question. And this goes to the, translation to me is always a challenge. It's, taking, one language and the nuances and the culture in which it's embedded. Could you translate this into Chinese?
If I had time, it's possible, yes. But I had to almost like a rewrite.
You'd have to start over. Because it starts.
Why would you have to start over?
You're better qualified to answer that than I am.
A lot of things, they are coded in English. For instance, just the title, "White Trash." How could I put this into Chinese? In English, it echoes white trash. That means trash is not just the garbage. Humanity is involved. But in Chinese, I don't know. You have to find the right word for it.
The idiom doesn't exist for it.
Yes, so. There are a lot of, I have to readapt a lot of things. I think there should be more closer to history, because even the military terms they use different, the nationalists, the colonists, they use different sets of military terms. In English, I simplify that. But if I do it in Chinese, I have to restore that.
I'm perfectly happy with it in English, but it may be those people advertising for their stories to be told would be served. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I, Paula, are delighted to have Hajin with us again. Please be with all of us when we come back. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. We are delighted to have Hajin with us. We are talking in particular about Hajin's new novel, War Trash. One of the things that you do that I found elegant, as there were so many, was you gave me a sense of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, how do you know this? Did you go to Korea? Did you go to these places? I mean, you give me a sense of the bird calls, of how the air feels, of where the ocean plays the role in these things. I felt in a place. Was that because you knew people from Korea?
In my first year in the Chinese army and first half year, we didn't have barracks. So we live among the Koreans in a Korean village for half a year. And so I knew their customs and some of their language. And when we traveled...
In Korea?
No, inside China, but on the border, there are Korean towns. So and the villages. So we live in a Korean village.
I was going to ask if the Chinese army was still in North Korea. I was about to learn something.
It was also interesting when there's a great conflict that the four Chinese who are in the midst of this are kept away from the fight within the POW camp.
Sure. Yeah.
Because had those guys, suddenly it would have been an international deal. And I was thinking, let's see. Yeah.
Yes. And that's kind of sense of hierarchy, because the Chinese, they call the Russian the big brother, the Chinese the second big brother, and the Koreans. So the Chinese in the middle between the Russians and the Koreans. That's why they treated the Chinese with some kind of a privilege, protection. Yeah.
When last we talked to you, we talked briefly about what you were going to write next, and since this is what you wrote next. But at the time, what I remember you saying, and I may have this wrong, Paula, correct me, was that you had exhausted your Chinese experience and that you were looking really at writing about the immigrant experience.
Yes.
And my first reaction was, well, didn't do that. But my second, once I got to the end of it, is that in a way it is transitional. There is that a little bit of the feeling of the immigrant, but even more importantly, is there's a little more sense of the universal.
Yeah, you are right. And in fact, this is a transition from my work from China to the United States. This is the set in a third country. And the ground is the place where different peoples interact. So for me to test.
A small step.
Yes, a
okay,
small
here
step.
Comes, yeah. Here comes another Paula liked the book. I had a sense that our narrator was every man.
I try to make him, yes. In a sense, yes, yes. I think by being an outsider, by being less attached to any group, he becomes kind of more general in that sense.
Did it reflect your own feeling when you came to this country and sort of got stuck here, and all of a sudden then everything changed and then you made some decisions?
I think so. My own situation gave a lot of insight, a psychological dimension to this character. Yeah, I do believe that. I could feel for him, I think. At least kind of identify with him.
Because?
Because my situation, struggle, try to find my position, and also sometimes content to stay outside of many things. As a kind of relative outsider.
So you,
I think any writer, a good writer, an artist, you always have that kind of sense of alienation.
This is a good thing.
Yes.
It's a necessary thing, whether it's good or not. It's probably
it's necessary. Exactly necessary. I mean, step aside from the crowd and the life, the current of life, and meditate and gaze at it.
When Paula said this is every man, it is, but it is not an omniscient every man. One of the striking things is how vulnerable he is to the immediate circumstances. Every now and then he will form an idea of what he's going to do. And just as soon, you know, almost inevitably, if he does, the circumstances will shift just enough that he's back on essentially pure intuition. It's not even rational.
Sure, yes.
He just reflexively does things, and he's an extraordinarily rational person.
Yes, very shrewd and cunning in that sense. I think that really helped him survive. In fact, he was sent, at one point he was sent to be destroyed, but he managed to survive, somehow even came back. Really, he's stronger, and he's a passive man on surface, but I think he's stronger, and he intuitively knew that English would help him. He continued to study it, reading the Bible, but eventually really make him different from, set him apart from the other POWs.
It was very wonderful the way that you juxtaposed one belief system against another, and the way that you showed how the draw, the power of the communist ideology was a strong foundation for many, particularly within the camps.
Yes, yes.
And then to put it as he's using the Bible as a tool of literacy,
yes,
and he's beginning to say, oh, that's, I get it. Were you also working with the power of ideology as you were thinking your way through that?
In a way, yes. I think because he's reading the Bible gave him kind of a religious dimension to his mind. He can see,
which he hadn't had.
He didn't had, and he others have the religious feeling, but that was suppressed or deformed and transformed on. Really focus on human beings rather than a god or a deity. So as a result, they became more fervent, more zealous.
It was also very interesting to me that in a fundamental way, this seemed like a meditation on the power of literacy.
In a way, yes. Yeah, sure, yes.
Because there were so many who weren't, and this one thing seemed to matter so much.
Yes. Yeah, and also the young boy you mentioned, how he thrived, again, the power of literacy. He lived a good, decent life by comparison. Yes.
Since last we talked, China, I think, has become much more, prominent in our thinking. The economic dynamism has attracted the attention even of Americans, since that's what we care about.
Mm-hmm.
But it appears that China is becoming more and more a central player in the world.
And in a way, yes, a bigger role now, I would say. Yes.
And in a sense, I think of Christine Lo, who lives in Hong Kong and sees her role as sort of intermediating between China and the rest of the world.
Well, and being a place one can experiment with different things.
Because Hong Kong is Hong Kong, but in a way, it seems that you occupy a roughly similar position of brokering between two radically different cultures at a time when we're going to have to deal with one another. Not necessarily get along, but we're going to have to deal with one another.
I had never seen myself.
It's a job you don't want, right?
No, I can't. I just want to tell a story, a good story that has resonance. But really, I I think if I write, a good thing is how to make the personal thing that is always meaning from the personal, and that becomes general, universal. I think that's very important. That's why I have to focus on the personal, start with the personal.
Well, haven't you done that really in everything you've written?
I try to, yeah.
I am fascinated by the fact that you have two mother tongues now.
I don't know. My English is still a stepmother now, I would say.
No, you are a favored stepchild, if that is
Well, your written English is just, I mean, and there are not a lot of people in the English. I mean,
the English language.
And I go back to Conrad, which is a great example in our growing up, that to be able to have that kind of command over the written language, particularly as a second language, is just extraordinary.
I'm flattered, but again, every book is a big struggle, and
But doesn't that, in a way, make you better? That you can't just sort of toss it off, as they say. That you really do have to find the right word.
There are advantages and disadvantages. You know, writer from my situation, such as like Conrad and Nabokov, look at their English, highly mannered but superb stylist, and the spontaneity is not their cup of tea, right? But they have other strengths. So, in other words, a writer from my situation, we have to be aware of our advantages and disadvantages, and as if we were born not as strong as the native speakers.
Different,
but it doesn't mean you can't be strong, but you have to see where you can be strong, how can you grow, develop.
This is a guess. Is some of your strength your ability to see that individual?
I think that as an outsider, that's a good thing, yes. And to be able to reflect on life, on things around you, this makes you more sensitive. And also, I think it's very important for a writer whose mother tongue is not English, but write in English, it is important to be aware of you have a different sensibility, to bring the sensibility and to the language, and also be aware of the style. Each story has its own style. For instance, this story demands a kind of unsentimental, stark, straightforward treatment, and eventually I think styles matter. I do think styles matter.
And each book is very different, each from the next.
For me, it should be different because each story is different.
We're going to go away before I have to interrupt Bill again. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell will continue the conversation when we come back with Hajin in just a moment. Please be with us. A couple more minutes here on the Paula Gordon Show with Hajin. We've really focused on war trash. Bill Russell, I will let you have yet another, but let me just pick up here for a moment. I had a sense over and over and over again that there was one line that could have been applied to everybody, and it was, I want to go home.
Yes, yes.
There is a sense that every individual in this book, whatever their rank or serial number or circumstance, there was this immense longing for home.
Yes, yes.
Is that the story you're telling? Is that your own story? What is this that is just layered through war trash?
Of course, we all have the longing, but the home is not just the one thing there. And home is kind of longing to find a place where we belong. Even the nationalists, those who went to Taiwan, for instance, the leader Han, and he gave a speech, and very moving speech in a way. You know, he confessed that he cried at night, but he had to be a individual, go to another place. And sure, everybody has a longing. I think in that sense, that is universal. But for the POWs, I think for many human beings, we tend to forget home is not a fixed state of affairs. It's a different, it's a fluid thing. It's our longing, our vision. And that's why when they return home, it's not the same thing. I think this is, in a way, it's different from Homer, when Ulysses, when he returns home, and he could restore his glory, and restore the household, and killed the suitors. But I know, for big generals, for big heroes perhaps, but for every individual, common soldier, I don't think home is like that. home is different. So in that sense, it is anti-heroic.
Yeah. Well, and many of these people, when they get home, it isn't home.
It's not. No, it's not home anymore.
Isn't that also a big story?
I think in that sense, yes. I think that is the, yeah.
Well, and that's part of the war trash, because, you know, what happens in a war alters everything.
Yes.
Including what you thought was home.
Yes. And the war changed not just these soldiers, also people, the civilians. Yes.
Thank you for a magnificent book. We can't wait for the next one. Yeah. It has been our pleasure to have you again, Hajin.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Once again, Hajin has produced a masterful story in War Trash. We thank him for giving us all access to universal truths lived out by ordinary people, soldiers trapped by the whims of the world. We also thank Hajin for his courage. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.